and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name's Sam Roggeveen. I'm Director of the International Security Program here at the Lowy Institute. And today it's my pleasure to welcome economist and political scientist Chris Blattman from the University of Chicago and the Pearson Institute. Chris's latest book is Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. And he's long been interested in why some societies are violent, oppressive, and poor, and what could be done about it. Chris, welcome to the podcast and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I want to start, Chris, on China. You may not be aware, but Australia's defence and national security debate is dominated by China, which has risen rapidly as a military power, of course, and which has behaved in a very assertive, sometimes antagonistic, sometimes bellicose way towards Australia in recent years. Your book doesn't talk too much about modern China specifically, but I want to ask you broadly about rising powers. What do you think are the key factors that are going to determine whether a rising power like China is going to be peaceful or warlike?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I can bring is all of this apparatus we get from studying lots and lots and lots of wars and what are the common patterns. And so a few things stand out. One is, you know, I start off the book reminding people that actually we forget this, but most of the time we don't fight. That fighting is ruinous. A war between China and any of its adversaries, and of course, anything aggressive between China and Japan or Australia or anyone in that part of the hemisphere would drag in America as well. And that would just be such a brutal and costly war for all sides that they're going to strive to avoid it, as they have. As the West sought to avoid a direct conflict and confrontation with Russia successfully for decades, as India has mostly successfully avoided a major conflagration with Pakistan for a very long time. So the best prediction is always peace, but that doesn't mean it's a particularly happy, friendly, or peace. It's a belligerent peace. It's a peace where I think both sides, there's a lot of brinksmanship. And I think against a rising power, China's neighbors can expect it to continue to throw its weight around and essentially wield this threat of war as its chief bargaining tool to get what it wants. And so it's in some sense, this is the other thing I think we learn from studying so many conflicts that happen, but also conflicts avoided, is that each player, each adversary expects to get, you know, a share of the pie more or less proportional to their ability to burn the whole house down. And so I think that's what we can expect from a rising China, is a slim possibility of war, but what we can for sure predict is that they're going to use this power to gain more of what they want.
Do you think we can say with confidence that China certainly won't be content to be a secondary strategic power in its own region, as it still is, despite its enormous strength? It is still second in military power to the United States. The United States has a huge advantage in the bases and facilities it has around the region. So China is in some ways still hemmed in. Isn't it normal behavior for major economic powers to also want to their status as a strategic power to match that economic power? In that sense, post-war Japan and post-war Germany are very much exceptions to the rule, that when great powers rise economically, they're going to want something, they're going to want a status that's very much equivalent to their economic size and to their, I guess, their physical size, their population size. And the point of friction here with the United States is that at the moment, it doesn't look clear that the United States is willing to grant China that kind of space.
So, I mean, every leader's desires exceed their abilities. Every society's desires for what they would like to be and do in the world exceed their abilities. So I think they're certainly going to desire, I'm not a China expert, as I said, I think it's extremely likely they're going to desire more influence in their hemisphere. And then they're going to have to choose how much to invest in that versus other things, right? And a lot is going to hinge on economic growth and stability in China, of course. And in the last 5 years, that untrammeled growth, even before COVID hit, that was looking like it was drifting downward somewhat. And of course, now we're in maybe a temporary era of zero growth. So we'll see what means and abilities they bring to bear to realize whatever status ambitions they have. I mean, it seems obvious that they have more at stake in the region than the United States does, however. And to the extent they long run grow, and to the extent they are long run pursuing their own national interest, I expect them to probably have a lot more, basically to use that bargaining power and the threat of violence and military superiority over their local neighbors to just get leverage on more and more issues. That would be the thing that's consistent. But I'm skeptical we'd see a world, I think it's far less likely that they do so through actual invasion or attacks.
Mm. Chris, by any reasonable standards, the United States looks, at least to me as an outsider, and I think a lot of people would make this argument, looks incredibly secure. Vast oceans, east and west, benign neighbors, north and south, the largest military in the world, thousands of nuclear weapons. So the idea that it might be physically threatened by a foreign power is a stretch. And in fact, I'll quote here briefly Abraham Lincoln in 1838, who made this point well before nuclear weapons ever came along. Shall we expect, and forgive me, I'm not going to do the I'm not going to do the accent. I'm not going to go all Daniel. Right. I'm not going to go Daniel Day-Lewis on you. So, shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasures of the earth in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. Now, even if you think Lincoln was wrong or at least too confident in 1838, surely the advent of nuclear weapons and particularly nuclear second strike capability in the 1960s made America's position basically inviolable. Any invasion would be met with instant destruction. Mm-hmm. So the question arises, why does the U.S. always regard itself as being so vulnerable?
So, I mean, the U.S., like most, you know, nations, I mean, there is a vulnerability to a nuclear attack, of course. It's avoided. Again, it's avoided through the same principle of that war would be so costly that everyone strives to avoid it. And in fact, a nuclear war is so costly that the incentives are even more powerful. So we should, I don't know, rest easily doesn't seem like the right phrase, but at least not hit the panic button. I mean, America has been vulnerable to terrorist attacks. And we saw, we just saw that world-changing event, and 9/11 is a good example. I mean, I think America's major source of insecurity, it does come from the South. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of insecurity and violence to do with this drug, gun, human trade that happens along the border. This, you know, in some sense, this is America's longest war. Even our avocados are controlled by organized crime. So I think those three senses of insecurity are felt acutely, but otherwise I don't really think of America. And I am an immigrant. I grew up in Canada. I moved here when I was in my 20s. I don't really think of this as a place that sees itself as vulnerable. So I'm curious if you disagree.
Oh, only in the sense that America, it seems to me, could be far less active in its foreign policy and could be far less warlike in its behavior in the world, and it would still be incredibly secure.
Yeah, and indeed a great many Americans would like to see America move that way. I mean, in some sense, that was the center of Trump's America First policy, and he's neither the first nor the last politician here to advocate for a less aggressive place in the world. And indeed, I think we may see that come to pass. I mean, I think one of the positive consequences of that, of his presidency, for, you know, is, I think, is a sense of that allies are stepping up. I think you look at Japan, you look at Germany, you look at a whole other host of allies who actually are deciding that, well, we no longer, maybe we shouldn't completely sit on the coattails of this one only mostly reliable superpower, and take more joint responsibility. And personally, I think that's a good thing.
So this goes to the issue of that you talk about a lot in the book, which is you place a lot of emphasis on reputation as a potential, one potential trigger for war. You have to demonstrate that you're willing to take extreme action in order to maintain your status and to avert future threats. Sometimes among IR specialists, I think this is referred to as credibility. I think you mean the same thing, is that right? Reputation and credibility, you mean broadly the same thing? Mm-hmm. But the credibility argument has been used to justify quite an expansive view of American interests abroad, i.e., for instance, at the moment, the United States needs to show a great deal of strength in regard to Ukraine in order to make China believe that it would intervene in Taiwan. Or even in a more extreme way, it has to stop terrorist attacks in Africa, or stop, you know, prevent terrorist cells forming in Africa in order to deter any attacks on the United States. So do you agree that there are dangers in putting too much emphasis on credibility or on reputation?
Well, yeah, do they overplay it? Well, let's step back for a second. So I've sort of said this premise that most of the time we don't fight, but of course I didn't write a book called Why We Don't Fight. I wrote a book called Why We Fight. And every answer to why we fight is a reason that a society or its leaders has overlooked those costs or is willing to pay them. And as you know, like in the book, I just sort of walk through, there's sort of five main ways that happens. It's a way to organize the sort of vast confusion. It's not the only way to look at the causes of war. I think it's a really convenient one. And what is reputation sort of blends in with one of those five that I call uncertainty. Because fundamentally, if war is going to, if so both of, let's say you and I are going to go to war. My ability to, or that's our option, right? Because we always have that option. Do we find a deal, or do we actually fight and sort of bargain through bloodshed? My ability to get a better deal without having to go that costly bloodshed route is in some sense hinges on how willing you think I am to just fight on and on and on. Just my willingness and ability to pay the costs of war are the fundamental bargaining tool that I have in my dispute with you. And then every dispute I have with you is a chance for me to send a signal about how willing I am to bear costs with every single other disputant I have to face in future. And they're all watching, right? Every time America is challenged, everybody's watching. And the reason this is all about uncertainty is because if everybody's strength and resolve and willingness to bear those costs was written on our foreheads, or pasted on, you know, the billboard in front of our, as you enter our country, then we would never have to have reputation, right? Everybody would know it's precisely because this thing is uncertain that we have to send costly signals. And I use the example, actually, because what your listeners might not know is that, you know, my day job is actually working one with rebel groups and criminal gangs and studying war at a slightly lower level. And there's a drug gang leader here in Chicago who talked to me. He told the exact same story, because this is true at every level. He the first time he got robbed when his gang started out selling drugs, he realized he either had to get out of the business, maybe get killed, but get out of the business, or he had to show them what he was made of. And so he realized, and so he hunted down and he killed the people who robbed him. And he had to do that a few more times until he'd established a reputation. I understand why he did that. Did he do too much reputation building? I mean, in my opinion, yes. I mean, I think I wish for a world where people like him weren't so self-interested and self-serving and weren't in such a cutthroat world. Does the United States engage in too much reputation building? I think from the perspective of I wish, you know, From the perspective that I recognize that any reputation building is totally self-interested, and I wish they didn't have to do it. Wish they didn't live in a cutthroat world. Yes, but otherwise, I don't know. I think it's a really hard thing to sort of get right, and so I think the U.S. has done things like fight a 20-year war in Afghanistan. No one talks about this, but why did they stay even when they were losing? Fundamentally, I think this was an exercise in reputation building. Even when we're losing, Americans are saying, this is how ridiculously costly and miserable we'll make this for you, so don't attack us.
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, I was about to ask you about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and to point out that actually sometimes attempts at reputation building can go completely wrong because your reputation is diminished by doing something aggressive.
Yeah.
But I think what I'm hearing from you is that you're saying even when it goes wrong, you still get a reputation for being willing to pay very high costs.
I mean, the reputation the United States would have liked to have is that we went in and mopped up in Afghanistan, and that's the first best reputation. The second best reputation you can say is, well, now that we've revealed to ourselves, and I think both America and Russia were surprised by I think they overestimated the capacities of their armed forces in both these fights. Now that we're meshed in this, whether or not how quickly we leave versus how much we just double down and show that we're willing to just pay any cost is a way to signal strength, right? And in fact, every possible adversary we have currently and in future is going to pay attention to this. So this is now an incentive for Russia, having revealed its weakness in some respects, to think about staying and fighting aggressively, even if it doesn't make sense for this particular, you know, rivalry, simply to send a signal to others that we're capable of doing this, such that next time we threaten invasion or threaten whatever we threaten in order to get our way in our region, you don't, you know, turn your back on us, that you think, well, it's not worth the cost.
You mentioned earlier the work you've done with gangs. I'm just curious what you think are both the lessons and the limits of what you can learn about war from simple interpersonal violence.
Well, I mean, a lot of gang violence, some gang violence is interpersonal. It's somebody from this other neighboring crew killed my brother, and so I'm angry and I have this hot reactive sort of reaction, and I seek revenge. And I think that's not a lesson that carries very well to larger group violence, including large gang violence. I think larger groups, whether they're well-organized large gangs or criminal syndicates or villages or political factions or ethnic groups or nations, are a lot more deliberative. But once we're at that level of like a deliberative group, thinking about whether or not they're going to attack another deliberative group's territory or seize what they have, I think there's a lot of parallels between how gangs behave and how nations behave. In fact, an awful lot of nations are run not unlike an organized criminal syndicate. And so, you know, I don't want to push the analogy too far because they are distinct. But I think the weird thing about my discipline of political science and economics is we've long sort of treated these as just totally separate phenomena. You know, and you either study civil war, international war, not both, let alone studying gang war. And so I think we just stand to learn a lot from seeing the commonalities as well.
I also wonder too about the connections for leaders between war and interpersonal violence. And occasionally, I just want to put this to you. Occasionally, I see on Twitter someone will make this outrageous suggestion about what leaders might have to do theoretically in order to go to war. So, for instance, if you imagine a situation where in order for the Russian president or the American president to actually launch a nuclear war, let's say they would first have to actually murder the guy that's holding the button, who has the suitcase with the nuclear button in it. What do you learn from a from a an outrageous scenario like that? Like, is there a link there? Does it, if leaders have to commit violence personally, does it make them less warlike?
Interesting. So I would say part of what you're getting at is, so, you know, again, is it relates in my mind to this idea of unchecked interest, which is another one of these five reasons for conflict. So, like I said, every reason we fight is a reason we or our leaders ignore the costs or willing to pay them. And one reason leaders are often willing to see their country or their group pay the costs of wars because they're not accountable for most of those costs, right? Their son's not going off to fight, and their building's not going to get destroyed. And so they're insulated politically, socially, in every way. And the extreme version of that is a personalized dictator. But even an American president is insulated from a lot of costs of war. And so they're going to be too ready to use violence. And they might even have a private interest in taking the country to war. So anything that makes them, anything that checks and balances them and makes them sort of more cognizant of those costs is I think, going to make them less likely to go to war. Murdering the person holding the nuclear football, I mean, it's I guess I'd rather see, you know, I think it's not the first check I'd look for. I mean, Vladimir Putin's a personalized dictator, right? And I'd rather see a Politburo than a personalized dictator. And I'd rather see a plutocracy than a Politburo. And I'd rather see like a Communist Party than a plutocracy. And I'd rather see, because the expanding circle of political power is what worries me. And so whether or not you have to murder, I don't know. I feel like there's an awful lot of, Saddam Hussein used to sort of just take people out in the hallway if he didn't agree with what they said in the meeting and put a bullet in them. So I'm not sure it's a deterrent for most, for some of the more ruthless leaders we have. Maybe if they had a son in the army or a daughter in the army,
yeah,
that would be. And we do have some evidence on that. Congressmen and congresswomen in the United States are less likely to vote for war and vote for conscription when they have a son between the ages of 18 and or 17 and whatever the, I can't remember, late 20s. But if nature flipped a coin and they got a daughter, you know, earlier, then they're just as likely to vote for war as somebody who, you know, has an older son or doesn't have children at all. So we do internalize these things when we feel the cost a little more personally.
Yeah. So just to ground this a little bit more, rather than the example I gave, there is a norm in international affairs against assassination of leaders. But is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's still a fair amount of assassination that goes on, or attempted assassinations. So I'm not sure if it's the best functioning norm we have. Plus, I mean, I'm not sure there's so many drones and missile strikes going around trying to take out leaders of non-state armed groups. I'm not sure that norm. I'm not sure that norm is so resilient any longer. Is it a good thing? I mean, I guess what the sense in which I think it's a good thing, I mean, other than the fact that I just don't think assassination, I mean, I don't think assassinating leaders would solve some of these fundamental problems. Like the political institutions, a lot of these countries are highly centralized. And so if a warlike leader were to die, I think another extremely powerful person would take their place. And it's not clear to me that their incentives are actually any different. They might even be worse. And so in the book, I say there's no good or bad leaders. There's just checked and unchecked leaders. And so the assassination doesn't, I think, really solve the core problem. And then it brings with it a whole lot of other baggage and moral issues. So to the extent that norm still exists, I'd support it.
I just want to ask you a few sort of meta questions about the book, Chris. Firstly, how does it, being an economist, help in writing about this stuff? I've said publicly in Australia that I think the level of economic literacy among strategic commentators is pretty low, and that actually damages the national conversation about defence and security. What's your perspective?
So, I mean, I think about, you know, I said there were five reasons we fight, and three of them come from game theory. There's the uncertainty story I told, which is, you know, and reputation building, which most people understand intuitively. It's like if you play poker, I think you get sort of the strategic logic. And the unchecked interest story is also game theory. And again, it's very intuitive. It's like, it's what game theorists call principal agent problem, but a normal person recognizes that, like, we the people, if we don't constrain our leaders, they're likely to do something that's not in our interests. And then the third, which, you know, I won't get into, we call a commitment problem. I would say economists have been highly responsible for fleshing out these ideas and bringing them into discourse and helping us see where they sort of matter in politics, but so have political scientists. But I do think it's sort of like, rather than sort of saying, I think it's the science of strategy or game theory that this sort of cluster of political scientists and economists have added that are so fundamental. And it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because they're, you know, I think the other reasons we fight come from psychology and sociology, really. And I think a lot of us leap to those. A lot of us, we sort of leap to these psychological explanations very quickly. They make a lot of sense. And then these more strategic ones, even if I think we inherently understand them when we're playing poker or negotiating for a used car, we don't learn to spot them in the wild and see how they shape international affairs. So to me, that's like the big addition.
Yeah.
But frankly, political scientists could have done it on their own and have made a lot of the advances. So I don't want to give all the credit to economics.
My sense is actually that just economists have a sharper sense of how incentives work. But it's easy for that to become kind of tautological. I mean, we all function, yeah. We all operate because of incentives, right?
Yeah. Well, and what economists have the benefit of is there's lots of other situations of conflict that belong more in the economic realm. So price wars between businesses, which, like conflict, totally costly for both sides. They often try to avoid them. Labor strikes. Most businesses and governments are not engaged in a constant labor strike. There's lots of threats of walkouts and strikes, but most of the time they find settlements. And court battles, just all the law and economics. And so a lot of the apparatus that I've talked about here, a lot of the reputation, like that basic logic of reputation building and some of the proof we have for it at lower and higher levels, some of the empirical data, and just the well worked out game theory of that and the deterrent effects of reputation. A lot of that was developed by economists studying labor strikes and price wars and legal battles and their rarity, rather than studying, you know, pitched battles with firearms.
So Chris, another sort of meta question, and this is a deeply unfair one. You're welcome to skip it and I can edit it out if you don't like it. If you were reviewing this book, what would you say was its most important shortcoming or omission or weakness?
Okay, so I'm going to partly dodge the question, but then turn that around and explain why I think it's also a weakness. Is I tried to write a book that was encompassing of all theories. So I'm not trying to say this theory is wrong and this, like, everybody else's book is wrong, this book is right. I'm trying to provide just a framework that I think makes sense for understanding all the theories. And so I think that's in some ways the book's greatest strength and it really speaks to me. I think it really speaks to a lot of people. And then I think, I think what that means is people who want to come away and sort of say, well, why do we fight? And you tell me what you think. I think I probably, in retrospect, am too even-handed in that I'm trying to give everybody a sense of where to place all their pet theories, all of which are probably important. And sort of buried in there is my own pet theory, but what's really fundamental. And maybe that'll be the next book. But I think I have to, having written the framework to understand all these theories of war and how to sort of sort them out in your head, I probably didn't sort of come out and say, here's really the answer.
And Chris, just finally, I'm curious, why write a book at all? What is it that books do for someone like you, a public intellectual and an academic? These days, you're someone with a very good public profile. You run a nice blog. You've got Twitter. You can write occasional long form essays for The Atlantic or the New York Review of Books if you choose to. Why do this at all?
So, I mean, I think like a role as an academic, especially an academic who wants to sort of shape public policy and I think what you have to do is you have to change the conversation. You have to just change the way that people talk about a subject. And you can partly do that through Twitter, as I do, and blogs, and sometimes even articles. I have been amazed at the extent to which I think books, as long and, you know, challenging as they can be to read, are becoming more and more important. It's almost as people have drifted away from short and long form journalism, and they want everything either in 220 characters or 400 pages to some degree, which is an interesting, you know, who would have predicted that? I think that got me thinking about this longer form. But also, I mean, trying to write a book that sort of organized everything everybody's ever said about conflict was also for me like a real intellectual journey and reward, in the sense that I felt like I just had to sit down and read everything and understand it all and then boil it down into something that anybody can understand. And so, I mean, a lot of the pleasure was in the journey for me.
Yeah. Chris, once again, congratulations on the book and thanks for your time today.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts and produced by Josh Godding. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode. Bye for now.